Hi, welcome to Trainwrecks for Jesus. I'm Mark Townsend.
And I'm Maggie Whitehouse. We're both ordained ministers who've left our established churches to become independents.
I'm a little bit pagan,
And I'm a little bit Jewish.
but we are both self-confessed train wrecks, and we're passionate followers of Jesus too.
So follow us as we discuss how falling flat on your face can also be falling upward.
Well, hello everybody, and it's lovely to be here with Maggie to talk through some questions on train wrecks, train wrecks, train wrecks for Jesus. So I'm going to ask Maggie a question too.
So you can shut up and have a drink of coffee, yes.
I'm going to ask Maggie a question now, which is, what do you think about mythology and what is it for?
Grief, that's a bit wide-ranging, isn't it? Okay, well, I do have a favorite quotation from Joseph Campbell about myth, and it is short enough for me to be able to remember it. So that's very helpful. Basically, I always quote him as saying, history is just journalism, and you know how reliable that is. He always
That's
says
good.
that myth is much more important than and true than history, because history is just journalism. And of course, history is always written by the winners, as we know. And one of the good things about the modern world is that we are looking underneath that history that was written by the winners and looking at the stories of the people who lost and how relevant they're lost in the terms of the animal human, that is. And he said something else about when the poetry of myth is simply looked at as biography, history, or science, it's dead. So basically, what he's saying, and I completely concur with this, and Richard Rohr says similar too, is that myth carries a deeper truth than history. Myth is not, as we interpret it now, just a fantasy. Myth is a perennial story told again and again and again, which has a message. And we all, I think there are great myths. There's the great myth of the hero's journey, or the heroine's journey, whichever you want to do, where the person has to leave because of a crisis, of some sort of crisis, they get thrown out and they have to go through a wilderness and they find troubles and strife and they grow in themselves and they find a kind of redemption. And then they attempt to take it back to the tribe. That's the great hero's journey. But it's not only a journey that somebody else comes to save you, it's a journey for yourself. And I was just writing an article for Unity magazine about Moses and the burning bush. And of course, that's a myth. There is this bush that isn't burning. And you think, yes, well, that doesn't happen. But if you look at it, I look through it at it through Kabbalah, the tree of life, because all the aspects of the Moses and the burning bush fit onto the tree of life, but they also fit onto the chakra system. You can actually put that whole story on the Hindu chakra system. And that's the groundwork for saying this is a genuine myth. Whether it happened or whether it didn't happen literally is not as important as the message in it. And in Moses' case, have I talked about this before on
You
Trainwreck? I
have
have, yeah.
about the burning bush,
Yeah, that's right. But it's a myth. It's a greater truth within a story that could be fantasy. Lord of the Rings is myth. Elizabeth Googe, one of my favorite authors, wrote a very famous book called The Little White Horse for teenagers about Maria or Maria Merriweather, who is sent to live with an uncle in a fabled little part of the country, which is a myth. And she has to save the family from the baddies. And in fact, the great thing about that myth, which I completely missed when I was a teenager, but get now I'm older, is that once she had committed to doing the work to restore, to end the feud between two families, it turns out to be really simple. All she's got to do is be brave and say, I will do it and follow the signs. And it's actually a very simple way to solve it. She has to find a necklace which one side thought the other stole, but turned out that the moon princess, she's a moon princess herself, just hid it in a well. Oh Lord, I've just ruined the story for generations. And once she finds it and restores it, there can be some hope of reconciliation. And I'm also writing the third of the Blue Panda trilogy at the moment, and that's going in very much into myth because it's about finding the ruins of the first temple of the Hebrews, it's mentioned in the Bible, and there's a lot in it. And Margaret Barker, one of my teachers, has done huge amounts of research on this and how the divine feminine and the earth was also honored and worshipped in the first temple. But that's been completely covered over now. And of course, if the Zionists want the temple to be rebuilt, because that has to happen before the coming of the Messiah, and of course, the Muslims back in the day made a graveyard in front of Jerusalem before the gate that the Messiah is supposed to enter in. So, because a Kohen, of which stock the Messiah is meant to come, can't walk across a graveyard because it's significant of death and dying. So they were trying to stop the Messiah coming. And again, that's a myth. It's not true that walking over a graveyard could possibly stop anybody of spiritual integrity. That's a negative myth. So I'm writing this book about rediscovering the archaeology of the first temple and finding it was not, it and the first, second temple were never on the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, so that there can be an alternate temple for the Jewish folk to worship
Oh,
at,
wow.
which
Right.
might help with the Middle East situation. That's what myth's all about. It's about trying to find the greater story. In my view, and part of my life's been a myth because it's been utterly ridiculous, but it's been a great journey. And even though I've fallen flat on my face most of the time, and that's another thing about living a myth, is that you understand that failure is important, which comes back to your book, The Gospel of Falling Down, and the book that we're writing as well at the moment, which is taking its time, but it'll come out in its own good time. And that's part of the mythical thing. Myths take their own time. You can't push it. And I know that even though my family certainly think I'm an idiot for the choices I've made, they've made me a much wiser person. And I quite frequently say that when I help in the community kitchen, I go for a paltry amount of time, which is 2 hours a week. And people are always saying, "Oh, it's not paltry. It's not paltry. You're a heroine for doing this work." And they're only saying that because they don't do the paltry 2 hours, to be honest. And it is paltry. And I'm quite open and honest that I think it is paltry. And it's all the time I've got right now. So it's good and it's paltry. And again, that's another thing myth will teach you, is that things are both good and bad, I think.
The reason I asked the question is because of St. George's Day, because
Oh, yeah.
there was there's the inevitable sort of whenever St. George's Day comes, there's this argument always about patriotism and nationalism, and because for some reason the English flag has a connotation that the Welsh and the Scottish flags don't have, a negativity, and I kind of find it amusing, some of the little things that come out about St. George, and the dragon, and the fact that he probably came from either Turkey or North Africa, and British English races use him, and so it's a bit of a piss take, when you, but also in the clearly it's a myth based probably on a historical figure, but the dragon must mythically symbolize something else. I mean, it's a clearly a myth. But the debate's really was really interesting, because there was quite a long debate that I had, and a chap kept sort of not defending so much as sort of just sort of asking me what. Or because I talked about it being a myth, he sort of assumed that therefore I had a problem with mythology, and I said to him, "But far from it. I far from it. I'm not disparaging it. I'm just saying, if you recognize that it's mythology, it helps, you know, it helps to sort of to release the tribalism and it becomes more universal. And then I went on to say something like, you know, mythology can, if it's literalized, be dangerous. And even in the Bible, there's a lot of myth. And so then we, and he said, well, where in the Bible is there mythology? So I just reeled off a few, Lot's wife, you know, Noah's Ark, Garden of Eden, that's packed full of. And of course, it can be dangerous. Mythology is a beautiful thing, but it's universal truths. But when you kind of literalize it, and let's face it, literalizing religious texts is lethal. It's not just dangerous, it creates us and them. And I was surprised that people can't sort of see that, especially at the moment with the amount of, you know, sort of pseudo-religious conflict that's going on. So and I often think that sometimes the problem with Christianity as a whole is that we've literalized a lot of the mythology, even in the Christ story. Because as you often point out, Christ and Jesus are not the same thing. I mean, obviously they're interwoven and interconnected, but Jesus is the historical figure. Christ is a much bigger term, and it does touch on mythology. I'm not saying that everything when we say Jesus Christ is mythology, but a heck of a lot of it is. I mean, John's gospel is filled with, if not myth, symbolic language, which is part of, like, I am the vine. You know, the I am statements, it can't be anything other than symbolic language, because, you know, and I just think it's very interesting how mythology is such a crucial part of healthy living, and yet it can be unhealthy when literalized. Do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with you. And you've just expanded on the Joseph Campbell statement, you know, that people tend to think that myth is trivial or a fantasy, whereas it's a profound truth. There's a Richard Rohr quotation, I can't remember it exactly, but it's something like, if it is true, it is true always and everywhere. That level of truth. But that doesn't mean to say that it actually happened literally. And we are so literal. We take things so literally and we choose to argue over how many angels can dance on the top of a pin. You know, the amount of times on social media that I've said, actually, that may not be what it says in the Bible. Like the other day when we were talking about days, lengths of days in the Genesis being God created the world in 6 days. And people think it was 6 earth days. Well, why on earth would the God of a universe this vast be standing on the planet Earth to create it, having, you know, and the whole point of the story is it says it tells he creates the lights and the dark and the water and the land. So he's patently not standing in our solar system. So it can't be a 24-hour day. I mean, that's actually just logical. People think it's a 24-hour day because they take it so literally from the point of view of a human being standing on the planet Earth. And that's a literal point. Whereas the word yom, some Hebrew dictionaries certainly translate it only as day because they're taking it from the point of view of how you use it in language every day. You know, I'm seeing going to see you in 7 yoms. But back then, they didn't have concepts of time the way we did. And it can also mean an eon or a length of time. So it's quite possible that God, whatever created the universe, I think it's God, but there you go. The universe was created in 6 eons. And if it was, great. And if it wasn't, it doesn't matter because it's an important myth.
And
I actually went horse riding in Montana with a Seventh-day Adventist who are very much into seven days. We used to go out riding his quarter horses. He's literally saved my life at a really difficult, well, not literally, figuratively, at a time when I was really lost and upset and frightened. And he actually said to me, that God created the world in 7 days. And I said, yes, I absolutely agree. And he said, you do? And I said, yes, but he wasn't standing on the planet Earth, so I don't know how long the 8 days were. And he went very quiet for a very long time after that, because he was, okay. You could see the logic in it. I don't know what happened with his faith, but I might have ruined it.
Oh dear. Yeah.
But
I love that.
Go on.
No, you brought up the hero's journey, and of course that's at the heart of so many of the stories that we love. I mean, and it's usually a kind of, it's almost like the David in the Bible. King David was the weakest, and he went out and slew Goliath. And it's often, I mean, I'm not saying that was the hero's journey, but it's often the weakest, almost like the fool figure, the one who we would never associate with bravery or whatever. And like Harry Potter to a certain degree, a bullied kid is under the stairs, or Frodo in Lord of the Rings. And they often go through a wounding. There's a mentor figure that's usually there somewhere in the background. And we can all relate to that, can't we? Every single, particularly those of us who are down on ourselves.
Yes.
I mean, they're wonderful stories. I just think life is so rich with these powerful.
It is, and there's so much redemption in them too. If you think about the Narnia stories, which I read not in any knowledge whatsoever that they were a recreation of the Christian story with Aslan as Christ, even though when he died and resurrected, I thought, oh, that's stealing a story. But Edmund, who betrays them, is forgiven. And that's the whole Judas story, ultimately, there is always forgiveness, and that comes into myth as well.
Yeah.
But we do also literalize them in that you've got to be saved by a hero rather than you are the hero to save yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, and you're quite right, you sort of think, I can't be the hero, I'm broken, I'm rotten, I'm this. And we do see, we've talked about woundology before, again and again nowadays, you see people taking on their wound and making it their identity. Whereas the whole Chiron myth or legend is about the wounded healer. You heal as much as you possibly can, and you use your knowledge of the wound for empathy and healing with others. And I see this so often, that people just don't do that. They'd rather hold on to the wound to give them an excuse not to live. It's very tempting. And I know when I had cancer, I could feel that temptation to say, I can't do this. Don't ask me. I have cancer.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did use it to a certain extent to avoid visiting my mother. But my relationship with her at that time wasn't easy. And she was making it very much about her. I mean, bless her cotton socks, when she knew I had this diagnosis, and it was a very serious one at the time, she went out and bought a little memorial for me, which she put in her garden.
No. Oh, my God.
Which had my birth date on it, 1956. So she could have chiseled on it the date of my death.
Oh, God. Bloody hell.
I'm laughing now, but what? At the time, I was saying, what the actual fuck?
Shit. Oh, God.
Oh, dear. What was my point there? I can't remember.
I can't remember.
The story's just so ridiculous. Oh, that's right. Yes, that's right. I used the disease to say, I can't come and see you. Eventually, my brother picked her up and drove her down to see me. But
bloody hell. She didn't bring the memorial with her, did she?
Well, she had got two, so she could have done that. I don't know why she bought two of them. It must have been two for the price of one or something.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Anyway, so I left that little myth plaque in the garden when we sold her car house after her death. I'm afraid I didn't pick it up and bring it home.
God. Oh, boy.
But there are little myths and there are big myths, aren't there? But I think Joseph Campbell's right. You have to live your life as if you are in a myth. You are in a greater truth. And I'm always talking to people about the power of affirmation, and they were very popular at the time when Louise Hay's book, You Can Heal Your Life, came out. And what they are basically are positive statements in the present, made in the present tense, like I love and value myself. And they're very boring because you repeat them 100 times morning and evening. And what they do is they carve a new neural pathway in your brain.
Right.
Because the way our brains are wired, if you repeat a thought again and again and again, you come to believe it. You know, it's like these old statements like money doesn't grow on trees or something like that, or where there's muck, there's grass. There's lots of negative statements about money, which is
Yes.
understandable because people can use money for desperately negative things, but money itself is neutral. It's just a thing, a thought. And I'm amazed at how powerful doing those affirmations are, but how quickly the world will bite in if I stop doing them. I have to keep doing them. And I also have to pick up the fact that all my thoughts are where I left them before. For example, I got into a bit of a bind recently. I think this is relevant, over the fact that I wasn't getting offered gigs. I've got a couple of gigs, but there were a couple of promoters in the Southwest who just would not use me. And it was getting to be mythology in my brain that they wouldn't.
Right.
And I started believing it. So
Yeah.
I was still bidding for the gigs, but I didn't see the point in bidding for the gigs. So I realized after talking to a friend the other day that actually I'd created this myth in my mind. It was also true that they hadn't been booking me. But I'd also created that myth as a wound in my own
Yeah.
mind. So I was believing it. So probably some of my energy to them was, you're not going to use me.
Yeah.
So I did a
Yeah.
whole series of affirmations and a visualization yesterday. And one of those dreaded promoters put up an opener at 150 quid on Facebook. And I bid for it. And I said, here I am bidding again. You've got to grant I'm persistent. And bless him, he came back and said, you certainly are. Would you like to do the middle on that gig? And
Oh,
that's an
brilliant. Yeah.
unpaid middle spot.
Right.
So my pride could have said, fuck off. I'm an opener
Yeah.
and closer. I'm a funny woman finalist. I get paid.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
I didn't, because I realized I was starting to break open that myth and
Yeah.
the man was giving me a chance.
Yeah.
So I had to get over the pride and say, yes, please. And part of the
Wow.
myth is about saying you can't expect the other person to value you necessarily. You do have to prove yourself, but you changed your attitude and he's now given you a chance. I don't know if that is that relevant to myth? It sort of is. It's about the power of the mind, isn't it?
It is.
So how can we say to people, how do you become the myth in your own life? By realizing that thoughts create things, like by realizing what Jesus said, ask believing and it is given. You know, and also this thing about never give up hope, because I love Terry Pratchett's books. It's a million to one chance, but it might just work. But it has to be a million to one chance in order to work. And there's one of the books where oh, this comes back to dragons. Sergeant Colon is going to shoot a dragon in its nadgers, using the colloquial word. And the only way to get rid of the dragon is to shoot it in its nadgers. And he's standing there on the top of a roof with a bow and arrow. And the others are trying to calculate whether it's actually a million to one chance or whether it's only a thousand to one chance. And they're getting him standing on one leg, pointing in the wrong direction to make it a million to one chance.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So be the myth in your own life. Don't take things so literally. Find the magic.
Excellent. I think that's about
I think that's about
I think
it.
I think that's a
Thank you.
that's about it for that one. Thanks, Maggie. Really,
Thank you,
really.
Mark. Bless you. See you next week then.
See you next week, everybody.